back together again. You and I, end of the week, wrapping up a busy week, Friday, June 2nd, 2023 on Connecticut Today. I started wondering if state lawmakers just need to have more time to do their jobs and to do those jobs better. Journal Inquirer of Manchester columnist Chris Powell stopped by for his monthly check-in. SEMA, the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association head Chris Herb, updated us on a last-minute push for a climate law change in Hartford. We welcome to Craig Nelson, author of V is for Victory, Franklin Roosevelt's American Revolution, and the Triumph of World War II. And finally, former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso stopped by for his weekly update. Supposing you were looking for a contractor, a home improvement contractor, an electrical contractor, some guy or gal's company to do plumbing work on your home, maybe put in a new pool outside, maybe go to a nice in-ground pool that you can afford or want to finance from that above-ground pool that you had. You know, you can't really dive into it, and the kids want something better, so you figure, oh, what the heck, let's do that. Or you want to put in that man cave that faces the outside of your backyard, or maybe a nice, you know, summer porch where you and the missus or the mister or your domestic partner can spend some time, whatever. So let's say you're serious about this and you've wanted these changes in your life or lives, or you've wanted these changes in how you live, where you live, what you spend on what you live, and the general happiness that is generated by where you live. So you start looking maybe 5, 6, 7 months out from when you and your specific other, or you, if you live alone, you habitate alone, and say, hey, here's what I'd like to do this. We can't really do this, in the dead of winter because the construction would be rough, or you can't pour concrete or whatever. So let's do this spring, summer, and fall. And by the time it gets cold, it'll be nice and toasty warm. So you start looking, you bring in bids, and this company says X thousand, I can have it done here. But if you want this accessory, you want a different kind of windows, it'll cost you more. You get the idea. Well, because a lot of you have done this, right? So you know about this. Well, imagine if you got a bid from a company or companies, and one or two bids you listened to in the entire process, as the Brits would say, of this, and you looked at these people, and this company seemed to be. You know, pretty together. They've been doing this, you know, the trucks pull up, quality renovations since, you know, 1940, family-owned company, 5 generations. That's 100 years. Yeah, pretty much. So they must know what they're doing. And they have Connecticut license number, and they're insured and bonded. And everything is perfect. They're a little expensive, but, you know people that know their reputation and say, hey, that company's great. You should go with them. Oh, they worked on my neighbor's place. It's a palace. They did my nephew's man cave. It's beautiful. Or his home entertainment room, whatever. And then you sit down with the construction boss, the foreman of your job, or, you know, the manager, the owner of the company, and he slides the form in front of you for the materials and the labor and the projected time. And then he says something to the effect of, hey, you know what, though? We've got to get all our work done by X days, by, you know, June the X, June 7th or 8th. You know, and you may say to yourself, well, why is that? You want me to commit a certain amount of trust to you, a certain amount of monetary commitment to you? And you say, well, wait a minute, I'm like every other customer. And the head of the company that you're negotiating with says, oh, no, nothing personally against you. No. But at the end of a certain date, you know, we're done for 5 or 6 months. We don't come back for 5, 6, 7, 8 months, maybe for another, you know, another 8, 9 months, a year. So if you have a significant amount of blood flow or oxygen running through your brain at that point, And supposedly this guy or this company or this group of people, you know, tells you, well, yeah, we can do what you want us to do, but we've got to be done with everything by X day. May 1st, June 1st, July 1, August 1, September, for whatever reason. Because if we're not done by then, we can't do any more work. But we'll get it done. We promise we'll get it done. What do you mean you'll get it done? Even if we can't have to come here all night. Wait a minute. Whoa. You're going to send construction guys and gals out here and plumbers and electricians and HVAC techs and stonemasons and everything. You're going to send them to my house. Yeah, because we have to get it done by X, Y, and Z date. Okay. You're going to sign a deal with those people? Or would you sign a deal with someone who says, hey, we'll take our time. Doesn't matter how long it takes. Mr. and Mrs. Jones, we're going to get that right. We know we're charging you 20 or 30 or 40 grand for this extra room on your house. So gosh darn it, we'll be here from 10 in the morning till 4, and that's it. We won't get here too early. We'll come here fresh and revitalized every morning, and after 4:30, we'll knock it off and get out of your hair. Wait a minute, so you mean to tell me you won't be driving nails and turning screws and trying to figure out why or why something's leaking, how to make it not leak? You won't be doing that overnight. No, why would we do that? You see what I'm driving at here, folks, to kick off? We're starting to get, this is crazy time now up in Hartford. This is the time of lunacy. And this is no criticism of specific people in the General Assembly, but this happens every single budget cycle and every year in the General Assembly, whether it's the short term, the 3-month term, in which very little damage gets done because everybody has to run for re-election again, or what we're in here is the odd years, the off years, when there's no real election pressure for the state house or the state senate or the governor's race. So this is when all the sleazy stuff gets done. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that, and you don't have to don't take it from me, but just go to any of the Hearst outlets, go to our friends at News 8, our friends at WFSB or Fox 61 or Channel 30 or News 12. Go to any of those outlets, and what do you see? You see something that drives me nuts. And as taxpayers in this state, it should drive you nuts. This all-out sprint now to get this bill done and the budget done and that bill done and these bills done. And whether it's a bill on the environment or the bill on gun control or a bill on gun safety or more of this environmental lunacy, this climate sleight of hand that's going on there now, this makes for lousy lawmaking. It does. This happened, and it's mind-boggling to me that you have 151 men and women of both parties in the state house, and you have 36 people of both parties in the state senate. So you have 187 men and women essentially setting policy in this state for 3.6 million people. And I say the constitutional offices don't matter. I mean, they propose things, but it still has to go through the House or Senate. And the governor, the governor sets a tone, delivers a couple of addresses, state of the state, the budget address, whatever. But that's kind of the sexy, cool thing to really argue about in this state. Where the rubber meets the road in lawmaking in this state, sits with, and you may know some of these people that may be your neighbors, maybe you're listening and you were once a legislator, so you know the 151 members of the state house and the 36 members of the state senate have to sit there and engage in this I don't even know what words to use, engage in this wheel spinning that happens every single term in the key years, especially in the key budget years, with some really, really, really important stuff, stuff that should not be jammed into the last minute of every session. How would your boss react? I don't care what kind of work you do. Doctor, lawyer, accountant, project leader, marketing, advertising, construction, or a blue-collar job, HVAC, car mechanic, civil engineer, carpenter, whatever. How would your bosses react, whatever level of management you have to deal with, and or B, your customer base react when once or twice a year you had to jam, literally, watching the clock, you had to do stuff that made no sense. Like we've already heard rumors of, and I've been chatting with sources all morning as to what's going on at the Capitol and what's not, the notion of bills getting rewritten and this getting taken out or that getting put back in. And again, I understand. That's how the horse trading of politics goes. Believe me, I've been covering this long enough, and I've talked to enough people to know what goes on here. Okay? I got that. I understand that. But man, this invariably, there's one or two or three stinkers that come out of every session. And a lot of the times, the stuff that does not make it through, stuff that did not have enough support in a House or Senate committee or in a General Assembly committee, you think it's dead. Oh, no, 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 no. You watch what happens next week. When the budget implementer bill comes rolling down the aisle in the Senate or the House in the General Assembly, usually at like 2-3 in the morning. I mean, what successful business tries to make head or tails of documents that are hundreds of pages? And you know what we're going to hear next week as we hear it over and over and over and over again. Well, the bill was delivered to the State House of the State Senate at 2:30 this morning. 2:30 in the morning. And we make laws that way. Seriously. We make laws that way. Why do we allow this to happen? I know you'd have to go through a lengthy process to change the end of session dates. Well, you know what? I'm in for trying this. I am. I don't know what you would have to do. Maybe we can. Well, you can't do an initiative here in the state. You can't do initiative and referendum like this. So I don't know when this looniness changes. And you talk to legislators on both sides of the aisle. Well, it's tough, you know, because we have dates we have to finish by. Well, guess what? I submit to you, Mr. State Rep or State Senate member, that the dates are idiotic, and they make for lousy laws. But to talk about what's going on at the Capitol, Chris Powell, I've got my Chris's confused. Chris joins us from his ultra-secure bunker somewhere. Mr. Powell, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Great to be with you.
Chris, I loved your column, the one that came out yesterday, because you talk about a couple of bills, and when I heard they were passed and going to be signed or whatever, I said, really? We needed to do these? I thought these were kind of self-evident, but why don't you go ahead and inform the masses about what our great lawmakers are doing?
Oh, well, they're passing the supposed gun control law, Paul, that is just full of little trivia. I laughed at the requirement for people to register ghost guns, as if the very point of having a ghost gun is making it not traceable. So who's going to register with the state police? Do you think the state police are going to have to put on extra clerical staff to take these registrations? I mean, I'll be surprised if they get even one registration. People convicted of domestic violence are going to be denied gun permits. Well, Do you think some guy who wants to murder his ex-wife is going to be, you know, deterred by the lack of a permit? This is all nutty stuff. Then they also were passing a voting rights law, pompously named after John Lewis, the civil rights leader and former late congressman from Georgia. It's going to incorporate in state law the former federal standards for southern states that wanted to change their election laws. So now we're going to empower the Secretary of the State and the Superior Court to adjudicate any changes in municipal election laws in towns that have been shown to discriminate against voters, except there are no such towns. We've never had this problem in Connecticut, and the voting problem we have in Connecticut tends to be concentrated in the minority-dominated cities, where the problem isn't discrimination against any particular group. It's discrimination against everybody by making people wait so long in line to vote because there's inadequate administration. But that's not racial discrimination. So this voting rights bill is a solution searching for a problem that we don't have.
Chris, it seems to me that everything we do here, the voting rights bill, and I know there's now a push for, you know, some early voting in Connecticut's only one of four states, shockingly, as progressive as we are, that doesn't have that. No excuse absentees. I mean, Chris, at what point do we stop and take a breath and say, okay, the excuses that voting is so difficult, when does that go away, Chris? I mean, elections don't really sneak up on you. I don't understand this incessant drumbeat of how difficult it is to vote. And as you said, if your lines are long, go to your city and town and make noise about that.
Yeah, I think we could encourage voting, you know, much more by just making it easier to get in and get out, which might mean staffing the polls a little better. But you know, these liberalization of voting procedures, the no excuse absentee ballot and the 14 days of early voting, they suggest that people just can't be bothered, that they just can't manage their lives. Maybe the premise of this legislation is correct. I mean, the world does seem to be going to hell in a handbasket, Connecticut especially. Nobody seems to be able to take care of himself anymore. People don't seem to know that having children entails expense. And yet, you know, every day we've got newspaper stories about some hard luck case where a woman's got, you know, four kids by three different guys and has no job skills and, just living in poverty. And she needs, you know, somebody else to give her more help. Well, is this, you know, state becoming really more inept? People can't take care of themselves on basic stuff like, you know, voting and basic stuff like having children. I mean, good Lord, this is the age of free contraception, free abortion around the clock, and still we got people with kids who can't take care of them.
Our regular monthly check-in with Chris Powell. Check out his stuff. Chris Powell, of course, longtime columnist, Journal Inquirer of Manchester. And Chris, undoubtedly, you, like I, have been watching the General Assembly for years and years and years. And again, you can set your watch by it, Mr. Powell. Certainly looks like that because of this truncated session we have, considered the long session, we're going to get this sprint till the end here, and we'll get the budget implementer and what's not in the bill and what's in the bill. And you've got the budget and traffic safety and, of course, the stuff that I'm hearing back and forth about housing and zoning. So land of steady habits, Chris, I guess, as far as the legislature concerns, maintains.
Yeah, we're going to get the budget at least, Paul. And even in that, I think there's some issues of justice that are not likely to be addressed. You know, we had the Service Employees International Union people demonstrating in front of the Capitol yesterday, and 50 of them getting arrested for blocking traffic. I'm not a fan of tactics like that, but those people have a point. They work in the homes that take care of disabled people, and it appears that they have not had a raise in 10 years. They work for the social service organizations that essentially are delegated most of the state's work with the disabled. They're essentially state contractors. And they haven't gotten a raise in 10 years, apparently, but last year in the new master state employee contract, there was $700 million in raises for state employees over 2 years. And then a few weeks ago, the legislature appropriated another $50 million in bonuses for the state employees in the name of their having worked during the virus epidemic. Mm-hmm. Here's a group of people who do very important work for very little money, and they haven't had a raise in 10 years. And, they might be able to get a tiny raise out of this session of the legislature. Now, I'm not completely sympathetic with them because, they watched very quietly while the $700 million in raises was appropriated for the state employees, and they watched very quietly while the $50 million in bonuses was appropriated for the state employees. And Now they're complaining that, they're hardly getting anything. Well, they do not have the courage to tell us that, as the old saying says, to govern is to choose. Mm-hmm. You can't give $700 million or $750 million to the state employees and expect that, more deserving employees are going to have what they want. You've got to get some of these people who are whining about their neglect to point out where the money is going. And, most of the money in government goes to government employees.
And Chris, and I tell this to people all the time on this show, and I'm sure you talk to people, who are you voting for, right? I mean, Chris, elections have consequences, and we see that over and over again. And, Chris, there is this innate fear, really on both sides, but I see mostly on the Democratic side, of daring to vote for somebody new, even though the person that you voted for 5 or 10 cycles may be, in your mind, not getting the job done. It's just maddening, Chris.
Yeah, well, there's, I think, a sense among the various government-dependent interest groups is that you can't criticize any other interest group, that anything any government-dependent interest group gets is deserved, even when you're being neglected as badly as the District 1199 people are being neglected. But, that's not how government works. The squeaky wheel gets the grease, and if you can't point out the excesses in government, you don't deserve anything more for yourself.
Precisely. Chris Powell. Chris, thank you as always. Strap in, stay secure in that bunker there, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you,
Thanks,
Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate that. Chris Powell, Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Here's something you might need to be informed of, because it could end up costing you and I some money down the road. We hope not. Chris Herb joins us from the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, representing a whole bunch of folks, mainly family-oriented businesses who deal in the energy industry. Chris, good to have you with us, and I guess we're looking at maybe a little attempt at an end around here, Chris Herb, that we thought pertained to an idea that was dead and buried, but I guess not.
Yeah, we are. We're heading down the final stretch of the legislative session, and this is when the sausage is being made, and it's getting ugly. There's legislation right now that we are extremely concerned about, and as you said, has the potential to affect costs from lots of different perspectives.
All right, so we talked to Chris. Folks might remember a few weeks ago about a bill that at the time would have given whomever the department head, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the DEEP commissioner, male or female, Republican or Democrat, down the road, basically the idea or the ability to unilaterally influence and put into place a lot of energy policies without a vote by the General Assembly. Now, we thought that failed at the time, but now what is this? I see there's an amendment here that would put that back in total. What's the update?
Yeah, so there's been something like a dozen amendments filed on the bill, which has been very active over the last several days. And what we're concerned about is exactly what you just said. And back to our original conversation is that unelected bureaucrats having unilateral power to enter into trade agreements and all sorts of programs that could, in the name of zero emissions, end up driving up the cost of everything. And Paul, what I'm talking about, and you know, we represent home heating oil dealers, propane dealers, gasoline dealers. What I'm talking about here is that they could go into valuing the cost, the materials it takes to build your house. You know, are you using wood versus steel beams? And in saying that there's a different carbon intensity for each of these, and then pricing it that way. So this isn't just about the fuel that you use to drive your car to heat your home. This is also about, you know, other parts of the economy, like the building sector, where you might end up paying more just to build your house. And that's so we're many industries are concerned about this. This is just not our issue this time.
And it's referred to, I guess, in the material I have here, Chris, as a, quote, Connecticut decarbonization roadmap. A lot of syllables there, Chris. But I think you're right. It's the vagueness of this. And you and I both know, because you've been up there enough to know, and I've been covering this for years, you can put down words in a bill, but if somebody pushes and shoves here, they can maybe construe that and lawyer that, Chris, to mean almost anything.
Yeah, I mean, when the bill, the amendments that we've seen on this bill are, there's some consistent language, and it basically says subsector targets. Now, number one, we're talking about legislation, the legislature targeting industries, targeting. I mean, you know, what happened to a government that's supposed to work cooperatively with industry in the best interests of the people of Connecticut? And now we're targeting people. And we're not saying who. So, you know, whatever industry you might work for, people who are listening to this on their drive home today on Friday, whatever business they came from, you might be the target. And you won't know it with this bill. But guess what? If the commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection decides to target you next week, you're going to wake up and find out what that feels like. And in the vast power that the government has is not fun to deal with when you're trying to fend them off. So right now we're trying to kill this bill before it's you they come after.
And Chris, I'm all for government doing what it thinks is necessary for the common good, whether it's taxes, the environment, transportation, banking, whatever. But the bottom line is, Chris, what I don't like is legislators going full Pontius Pilate here and washing their hands and knowing, Chris, that they say, well, you know, this issue could get me a loss at the polls here, so I'll just leave it to the deep commissioner here. These commissioners, Chris, you know, to be different if they were elected here in the state. They're not. They're unelected bureaucrats. And I think people need to know that major chunks of policy would be handed over to people who can have executive fiat here, and your elected legislators can say, hey, don't look at me. I didn't vote for this.
That's right. You know, we don't want to give any blank checks to people who are ultimately accountable to the taxpayer and the voter. And the language like this has that ability where you can just pass the buck and say, you know what, it's the commissioner. It's not me as your state senator, or state representative. And so, you know, we want to get our arms around that. There are legislators who get it. There are amendments that try to do that. But at the end of the day, you and I both know that trying to do that little bit of, you know, sleight of hand that, you know, push off the responsibility of somebody else is where they're going to land. And that's why we don't like the bill at all. We want it gone.
All right, Chris Herb. Chris, thank you. Appreciate it. Keep us up to date. Text me, call me, and we'll get right back to you. Thank you, sir.
Good man. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Chris Herb there from the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, CTEMA.com. Yes, they represent, as Chris likes to say, home heating oil retailers, many of them mom-and-pop businesses, gas station, convenience store owners. So essentially, there is an 11th-hour amendment or amendments that would grant whomever the commissioner of DEEP is, the Department of Environmental Energy and Environmental Protection, the DEEP commissioner would have huge power. And I've read the text of this, and listen, I'm no lawyer here, but I'm like, really? That's kind of vague. This was in a previous bill that was killed. I think that was Bill 1145 that we talked about weeks ago. So they're trying, a couple of legislators are trying to amend. This is how they do this in Hartford, even in D.C. And I hate the amendment process. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. pass standalone bills, pass clean bills. You want something else? Introduce another bill. Well, that takes time, Paul. Well, yeah, it does. Nothing should be easy. So basically, the pushback here is not to understand something, folks. When I talk about this and other hosts and other industry people, it's not that we don't want sound environmental policy. That's not the point. The point is that when you're debating policy on the environment or banking or transportation or housing or any of that, that should be debated and voted on by lawmakers, the men and women, the Democrats and the Republicans, that you and I put our vote in every 2 years and say, go to Hartford and represent me. But from what I'm reading here, this is similar again to that Bill 1145 from a couple of months ago that got spiked because, you know, myself and the other hosts around the state and enough people screamed and said, hey, we don't want to give the commissioner of DEEP, nothing personal against him or her. Right now it's Katie Dykes, but nothing personal. Just no, you don't give somebody, some unelected bureaucrat, even though they're nominated and named by a governor, they still did not subject themselves to whether or not the people want to give them their vote. So they're unelected bureaucrats. That's not how you make policy. It's not. It just isn't. Now, a lot of people may say, well, we can never get something passed in the General Assembly because nobody can agree on environmental policy. Well, too bad. Put some stuff up there, yell and scream at each other until you come up with a few points that you can agree on. What's the old rule of negotiating? You go in understanding you anything you want, you break down in three sections. There's generally stuff you're never going to agree on with the other side, right? Then there's stuff, even if it's minor stuff, that you would agree on. That's two of three. And then three of three is the stuff you really try and give and take on. So it ain't hard. It takes time, but again, here we go. Gotta get it done by next week because of this dumb constitutional time frame here. Well, it's a Friday, so we're kind of trying to wind it down with all the hardcore politics. Maybe you want to curl up with a good book this weekend. This one is already on my list to get. I find this fascinating. Can't get enough of the Roosevelt era if you're a guy like me. Between the books and the documentaries and everything, our next guest and author, he's the author of Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, the New York Times bestseller Rocket Men, the epic story of the first men on the moon. You've also seen his work undoubtedly in Vanity Fair, The Wall Street Journal, Salon, National Geographic, The New England Review, Popular Science, Reader's Digest, and a whole bunch of other famous publications. He's got a brand new book out, this one just coming out. V is for Victory, Franklin Roosevelt's American Revolution and the Triumph of World War II. Craig Nelson joins us. Hey, Craig, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great.
Well, Craig, this era is fascinating to me. I've read numerous books about this whole Roosevelt era, documentaries. I can't get enough of it. And Craig, it seems that the more we think we know about this era, pre, during, and post-World War II, I mean, we really don't. We have authors like you kind of bringing us new and interesting scenarios here. So talk about this. Boy, FDR really was in a position, Craig, where the nation was still reeling in a bit from World War I. You had the America First movement, the Stay Out of the War. So Mr. Roosevelt really had his hands tied here.
Well, I really think what people don't remember is how really horribly grim and gruesome the Great Depression really was. When Roosevelt took office in 1933, the Dow Jones, the Wall Street had fallen 85%. 5,000 banks had failed, taking people's life savings with them. Our military was 14th in size in the world, smaller than Portugal, bigger than Bulgaria. And people had been beaten down by, in turn, the Great War, the Spanish flu, and the Great Depression. So our country was really at its worst possible state when he took office. And when he left, of course, we defeated the greatest monster in human history and were on top of the world. So that's why I call this a revolution.
And he did this incredibly, Craig, you know, being persuasive with lawmakers, dropping the hammer when he had to. And he also, Craig, was one of the great communicators, was he not? He had to sell this to the American people, didn't he?
Well, he was the number one star in what was the internet of that time, radio. And tens of millions of people would listen to his speeches on the radio. And you can hear them today on YouTube, and they are fantastic. Because what they do is they don't just offer people a way of fixing their pocketbook problems and a way of fixing fundamental problems. They offer a way of making people feel ennobled. And when you hear him speak and how he says, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, mm-hmm. and I want you to join with me in banishing these notions, it's a totally different from politicians today, and that's too bad.
Craig, I've listened to those speeches dozens of times each, whether it's just to put me to sleep at night, to relax me, or if I'm just working around the house. He had that kind of New York State noble way that he spoke, and it was almost like, Craig, to me, you were listening to a real leader. He almost had that royalty about how he addressed the common man, didn't he?
Yes, he was able to be both the man you wanted to be running things and a guy you could have a beer with at the same time. He really pulled off this friendly man living next door to you. But his speeches were so powerful. The first one he gave, the very first fireside chat, was to tell people to stop being afraid of banks.
Yes.
And he stopped the banking crisis with that one speech. He completely changed it.
Yeah, please. Yeah, right, Craig, please don't take all your money out of the banks. And I listened to that for the first time like years ago, and it struck me as to the way with authority, Craig Nelson, but also how he, I don't want to say dumbed it down, but he explained it plainly to people, and I could see how he succeeded there.
One of my favorite FDR moments is he's not even giving a speech. He's at a press conference, but it's being broadcast on the radio, of course. And he's giving a press conference, and he goes, let me put it to you this way. Let's say your neighbor's house is on fire, and you've got fine garden hose. And I'm telling you, every person I interviewed who is alive at this moment remembers this talk about the garden hose. And so, of course, people said to themselves, well, if it's going to save Great Britain, of course we should lend them our fine garden hose. It was genius. Just genius.
Absolutely. Best-selling author Craig Nelson is the guest. V is for Victory, Franklin Roosevelt's American Revolution and the Triumph of World War II. Now, Craig, obviously the lead up to World War II, some people, you know, have always said, well, you know, FDR knew. From what I'm reading, it's like, well, we kind of thought the Japanese would do something, we didn't know where. So how early, Craig Nelson, was FDR thinking, this could get a little gamey here, I'm going to have to convince a lot of people to help out? What was he thinking?
He was thinking in 1938, when Britain and France turned over pieces of Czechoslovakia to Hitler to appease him out of continuing his campaign against Europe, that this was a false idea and would fail, and that America needed to defend himself. And he launched his program to dramatically expand our warplane production, both to boost our own air forces and those of Britain and France. And it would also boost our economy by selling those planes overseas. And that little program became the arsenal of democracy that was the secret weapon to winning World War II.
And is that the Lend-Lease program? Because I knew that was key in the whole thing as well.
Lend-Lease was that garden hose thing I was telling you about.
Yeah.
Where they told people we were lending them garden hose when they met tanks and trucks and planes that we probably were not going to get back if they were used to beat Hitler. But anyway, all of this was a process he was doing where he was sending American machines into war and not American lives.
How difficult, Craig, or maybe it wasn't, you tell me and my listeners, to get all these titans of industry and the car companies and all these other industries that participated in this to put their consumer goods businesses on hold for years, 4 or 5 years, and click over to war manufacturing? Talk a little about that.
Well, he brought in one of the great men of Detroit, a man by the name of Bill Knutson, who was president of GM. But Knutson wasn't tough enough on his own fellows in the car business. So FDR had to swing the hammer, and he withheld aluminum and steel from car manufacturers until they switched over to defense.
And I guess that worked, right?
Yes. Couldn't make cars without steel,
yeah,
so yes.
did this feed into, I guess, some resentment that still lingers today, Craig Nelson, that, yeah, FDR did what he did, but he was a little too ham-fisted here, or not? Do people look at him and say, well, listen, he may have been a little ham-fisted, a little dictatorial, but it saved the world?
He was a political operator. I like to say that he was the greatest politician in American history, and I mean that in every sense of the word. If you were not on his side, he drove you crazy because he was able to get around you and get his way and have things go exactly the way he wanted, and he was just steamrolled right over you. So that's why there's so much resentment. People who lost are still mad.
Yeah, but again, we're talking about the free world here, and I guess people could be, resentful, but I'm sure, Craig, there must have been times, and I've seen them and read about this, where, Mr. Roosevelt said, well, you may not like this, but we're fighting two or three nations out there for the survival of democracy.
When he started in 1933, the United States had produced 33 tanks. In its entire life as a nation. And if you were in a tank battalion for training, you didn't have a tank to train in. You formed up with four other guys and pretended to be in a tank. And if you were training in the Air Force, you didn't have real bombs to practice with. You dropped bags of flour. That was the state of our military in the 30s, and that it rose up to defeat Hitler as long as the civilian power behind the arsenal of democracy is an amazing achievement. You couldn't make this story up.
Oh, that's amazing. How angry, Craig Nelson, was FDR at people like, well, Charles Lindbergh, who at that time was obviously considered an American hero, Lindbergh and others who were saying, hey, this is Europe's problem, Craig, not ours. What were his feelings?
So this was an incredible moment in American history because Charles Lindbergh was the most famous and admired American in the world, and his son was kidnapped and murdered, and he blamed this on American society and exiled himself and his family to Europe, where he fell in with a bunch of hoity-toity Britons who said, Hitler's going to take over. Don't just get out of his way. Don't even try stopping him. He came back to America to spread this message. And he and Roosevelt would alternately make speeches on the radio, and the American public to listen to them. It was called the Great Debate. The American public could listen to this and decide on the future of the country. And it was really our American Democratic Republican process. It worked. And it really worked.
And finally, and I know I've read a couple of books about this, and Craig, I find this interesting, the dynamic between FDR and Sir Winston Churchill. Could America have won? Could FDR have pulled off his V for victory without the counsel and friendship and cooperation of Mr. Churchill?
It could, but both Churchill and, in fact, the Soviet Union kept Hitler at bay for the period of time we needed to get our production up and running. So they were crucial in the year 1940 and 1941, and then we were finally going in 43 or so. So that was where it wasn't the winning of the war in the end. That we could have done almost entirely on our own. It was giving us time to get ready that we needed those allies for.
I have to ask you finally, do you think Neville Chamberlain is treated unfairly by history, Craig, or not?
No, he really did a foolish job with believing Hitler was going to stick to his treaties. He wasn't cautious enough in what he was doing. But there is a hilarious story in that
sure.
he lost his job at prime minister because of the loss of Scandinavia to Hitler. But the guy who was really in charge of losing Scandinavia was Churchill, who now became prime minister. So it's a British history.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing history. V is for victory. Franklin Roosevelt's American Revolution and the Triumph of World War II. Craig Nelson, the guest. Craig, thank you. Good luck. And hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
You bet, Paul. Anytime. Bye-bye now.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Craig Nelson, V is for victory. Franklin Roosevelt's American Revolution and the Triumph of World War II. Did you hear that? America had the number 14 army in the world heading into World War II. We had a smaller army than Bulgaria. What did Craig say? We had produced, now granted it was World War I, we had produced 33 tanks to our name. That's fascinating. It's just, you know, you think you know. There's no other topic, I think, even more than the space program and other parts of history. World War II, there are always new stories told, new ideas for books, new interpretations. Fascinating. Weekly check-in with Chris Caruso, who watches what's going on around Connecticut, and he keeps a sharp eye out for the Stunads and Cavones out there. And he will call them out. Mr. Caruso, how are you?
I've been known to do that, especially the Cacchiarones.
Oh, that's what I was called growing up, yes, which, of course—
My mother, too.
And that, folks, that's Italian for motor mouth. If it's somebody who won't shut up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My uncle used to go, Cacchiarone, uffa, kid,
you know
what, shut up.
You know
up.
I love talking to you, Paul, is because you and I grew up probably very similar, an Italian family, and all. And all the slangs and everything else we heard, and just brings back some good memories when I speak to you. That's
Chris, when you were in
when
you were in the General Assembly, I doubt I could go back to the State Register and find you using the word "cacchiarone" during a debate.
No,
up there.
No. There was decorum and order, that's for sure. You know,
Chris, what's on your mind on this Friday as we head into the weekend?
Well, the first thing, I just want to pay tribute to a radio icon, John Labarca.
Yep.
Or as we call him, JLB, and he was a good friend for over 30 years and really a loyal supporter, a storyteller of the Italian community. And, you know, we're all going to miss him and his radio programs. You know, he did so much, whether it be Swim Across the Sound, you know, programs for the homeless, programs to end domestic violence. You name it, he was involved, and he put all of his time and effort, very generous to people, and I just wanted to recognize him. And just to let the listeners know that his wake is going to be this Sunday from 12 to 3 at Zima, which is a funeral home in Stratford. The funeral services are private, but anyone out there who loved John or listened to John, I'm sure his family would love to see them at the funeral home this Sunday, 12 to 3.
And if John was a state legislator, Chris, everything would have passed with a unanimous vote, knowing how he could, right? He would sell people on everything.
Yeah, he had such a larger-than-life personality, and he was just a goodwill ambassador for Bridgeport and for the community. And it's like, you know, listen, none of us are going to get out of this thing alive. You know, we're all going to meet our maker one day. And it's John's turn now. But, you know, you see all these people passing. And you know what John represented was community. And today it's become so individual. You know, people are concerned about themselves. What's in it for them? What's in it for themselves? When John was there, it was always about community. And I think, unfortunately, we're losing some of that. So when we lose a guy like John, we lose a bit of community as well, which I regret, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I want to talk about is the pancake process in the legislature. I don't know if you ever see these metal devices. It was a funnel. It was made in metal, and you pour the pancake mix in, and then you trigger, and a plop of the pancake comes out on the grill. And that's what we're going through now. You know, at the beginning of the session, back in January, it was about 3,000 bills that were put in. And at the end of the day, you'll probably get maybe 200-300 bills that will go through the process. And I marvel at it, even though I've been out of the legislature now for over 10 years. I still watch CTN. I still watch how the process goes. I see how bills are negotiated. And those bills that meet the muster continue. Those that don't, don't. I know a lot of people don't like the process, but when you have 186 people, all different opinions, all representing different constituencies, at the end of the day, it does work. And, you know, I know now you're seeing gun legislations going through. The budget is going to be going through. Some major stuff out there. And, you know, people should pay attention to a lot of this stuff, you know. And a lot of it happens. You have your public hearings and all, but the negotiations will really advance the legislation. And frankly, if the legislation doesn't stand muster, it doesn't get the support, it dies on the vine. And that's the way the process worked. Very condensed process, don't forget. You only, the first year you have 6 months, the second year you have 3 months.
Mm.
And that's because Connecticut at one time was an agriculture state. And it was really, you know, when they were harvesting the fields and they had to, you know, pick the product and get it to market, that's how you got the 6 and 3 month periods. And it's pretty much stayed that way. So I know I've been listening to you and different topics that are being voted on, so I thought I'd throw that out there, that the pancake mix is getting cooked, you know?
Yeah, Chris, does the time frame bother you? Because if you heard me today, I was like, I understand that a lot of people say, no, do not have a full-time legislature. I get that. I understand it. But, Chris, like I was saying before, and you've been up there and you can speak to this because I certainly cannot. My head would explode, Chris, if I'm up there and I'm asked to have critical thinking about billions of dollars at 2 or 3 in the morning, knowing that I have this deadline that comes up, Chris, which is, you know, really artificial. And I know there are people that say, well, you know, the less government, the better. But, you know, what's going to happen, Chris, next week is the legislative leaders, and you've been up there saying, well, this is the best we could do up against the deadline. What are your thoughts about, should we go 6 months? Should we go 9 months? I mean, would that help the process or not?
I think it would, Paul. There's no question about it. You know, when I was up there, I started in 91, and we would come home 3 in the morning.
Oh.
You know, I'd actually be leaving the Capitol 3. Time I got home was 4:30. I'd pull over in the rest stop and sleep because I was exhausted. So I get home maybe 5:30 in the morning, and then I had to be out there again for 9 o'clock. It's gotten better, though, now with the new speaker. He's letting people go home at 10, sometime 11. But the Senate, if you watch the Senate, they're up till 2-3 in the morning.
Mm.
So it's a very condensed process. If you expand it out, you'll probably get, in some cases, better product. But you'll also probably get more dissension between factions because it gives you more time to try to work something out. And more time sometimes leads to, you know, more dissension. The truth be told, Paul, the legislature is full time right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at the time you spend in Hartford, the time on weekends with constituents, even during the weekdays, even sometime the summer months, you're in committees or task forces that are being set up. It's pretty much full time. That was one of the reasons why they increased the salaries.
Yes.
But what they didn't change because it's constitutional, they didn't change the time period, the 6 months and the 3 months. But I think if you could stretch that out, it probably would be a better product. I'll be frank with you, too. All the amount of legislation coming through, it was impossible to read every bill from beginning to end. And what ended up happening was legislators became experts in different topics. For example, I became an expert in ethics. So I became an expert in election law. So people would come to me and ask me, hey, tell me, give me a summary, Chris, on what the bill is.
Mm.
Then there was someone on environment, someone on guns, like Mike Lawler was, you know, his background was working on the gun legislation. So people would go to him. Each bill has a summary, so you read through to find out what it's about. But if a particular bill had an interest to you or your constituents, then you read the whole thing. But it's virtually impossible to keep up with the volume of legislation. And the other problem is when you have 3,000 bills coming through the process at the beginning, the fool would be one who sat down and read 3,000 bills because you just couldn't do it, right? And I remember, you know, freshman legislators would be at their desk of these piles of bills. I said, what are you doing? Oh, well, I'm reading all these bills. I said, but, you know, half of them aren't even going to get through. So, you know, it's and I think it's set up that way. It's condensed. So that way you got to act and you got to act within a time period. But I think you could extend it. I think you could, you know, change the process somewhat to make it smoother, a little easier. I think there's always room for improvement.
Yeah.
It will take, though, an amendment to the Constitution. Modify it in order to do that because the way the Constitution is written as far as when the legislature meets. And keep in mind, Paul, the legislative duties has increased from when I was up there beginning in 91.
Mm-hmm.
The responsibilities are greater now. There's more transparency that's happening. There's more demand placed on the legislature. But, you know, when people just arbitrarily criticize elected officials, I always have told them, you know, run for office.
Yeah,
go see what it's about.
You're right.
And then tell me, you know, the Cacarones.
That's right. The Stunads and the Cavo. Yeah, that's a law firm. Yeah. Good morning, Stunad, Cavone, and Cacarone. Can I help you?
Yeah, but no, I think there's always room for change in anything, Paul. I think it's healthy when you do change and you progress. And, you know, any given time we could look at the process and see how we could fine tune it, how we could make it more receptive. I'll give you one example.
Sure.
When I was chair of the GAE committee, I used to get the politicians so angry with me because the tendency is you put all the politicians at the beginning during public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did, I said, whoever's a citizen or whoever's, you know, from a town, you come up first and speak. And then all the other politicians would speak at the end. You know what that did? It cleared the room. At the end of the day, I didn't have any politicians. See, they wanted to be up front with the camera and the microphone.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I had people sitting there that were, you know, average citizens working. They had to get back to work. So I would bring them up in the beginning, and that used to drive them nuts. But a little change like that goes a long way. It says to a person, hey, I'll go up to Hartford, I'll spend the time, mm-hmm. and I'll testify, but I won't have to sit there for 8 hours before they call on me. You know, so changes like that are always healthy.
Absolutely. Chris Caruso, great to hear from you, my friend. Have a good weekend. Yeah. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Yeah, he's right there. Now, number one, if you go to talk in a public hearing, right, these public hearings are, I shouldn't say never, but they're usually like on a Monday or Tuesday and, you know, middle of the day, 9, 10 a.m., 11 a.m. And if it's a contentious bill, you've got, you know, maybe 100 people who want to speak. So good on Chris. I don't know whether they still do that, but, yeah, put the people first. Absolutely. I've never spoken on a bill up there. I've had friends that have done that. Friends of mine who've lost loved ones to drugs. A good buddy of mine in this business, he was adopted, and he's been very passionate over the years, for example, regarding adoption laws and having the ability to find birth parents. Some people are very passionate about that. Others say, well, no, you know, if the birth parent doesn't want you to know, they don't want you to know. But he was able to go up twice and testify about that.